Welcome to episode 443 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Dr. Ben Stevenson. Ben is a physiologist and performance planning lead for Great Britain's paratriathlon squad. In this interview, we discuss Ben's PhD research, and we go in depth into the thermoregulatory stress of racing in the heat, and into how to use heat preparation protocols to prepare for that. We also discuss the performance planning process using a case study of one of the Paralympic medalists to see how things are done in a high-performance environment like the paratriathlon squad at Loughborough. Just really quick, before we thank our sponsors, I want to mention again that registration for our 2025 training camp in Mallorca is open. This camp will take place from the 5th to the 12th of April in 2025, and you can find all of the information on scientifictriathlon.com/Mallorca or through the link in the episode description. Now, before we get into the interview, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They create carbohydrate and electrolyte products that are effective, practical, and tasty. To me, the number one thing that any sports nutrition product needs to have is that they should not cause flavor fatigue, even in very long races, because even a relatively minor reduction in carb intake from your plan could be the difference between a PB and walking the last 10 kilometers of the Ironman marathon, for example. So the product you use needs to still be appealing enough for you to keep fueling at the end of your race, and this is one of the biggest advantages of Precision Fuel Hydration's carbohydrate products. The flavor of their gels, including the big flow gel with 300 grams of carbs, makes it easy to consume as much as you want for hours on end, so you can really stick to your plan throughout the race. And don't forget, you also have drink mixes and chews as alternative energy options, and of course, electrolytes for your hydration needs. You can get a free plan for your next race with the Fuel and Hydration Planner on the Precision Fuel and Hydration website. And as a TTS listener, you can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS24 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Indoor Swim Trainer is a dry land swim bench that allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. For a lot of athletes, the limitation to swim training is the time commitment, especially for those living a bit further away from the pool. If you need a 2 to 2.5 hour time window to be able to swim for 60 minutes, then it can make it very difficult to swim more than once or twice per week, as finding these kinds of time windows in a busy schedule is quite a challenge for most of us. If you are in this situation where you're restricted on how much you can swim, you can use the Senate to complement your pool swimming with quick and efficient home-based workouts that challenge the swim-specific muscles, including core strength and stability, and give yourself a chance to keep improving your swimming even when you have limited time in the water. You can try the Senate risk-free for 30 days and get 20% off your first order on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, here's the interview with Dr. Ben Stevenson. Welcome to the Triathlon Show, Ben. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's great to have you, especially after a long day driving back from the Paralympics, as you just told me. So maybe that can be a good segue into you introducing yourself a little bit more for the audience.
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Ben Stevenson. I'm currently employed by the UK Sports Institute, where I'm a physiologist and performance planning lead for British Triathlon's Paralympic program. So as you just alluded to, my voice is a little bit hoarse after a couple of hours cheering on the guys in Paris on Monday.
Yeah. So how long have you been in that role? And can you tell us a bit more about what you do in the day to day within it?
Yeah, so I've been in my physiology role with the sport in some capacity, at least, for nearly 10 years now. So I first started working with the sport whilst I was doing my master's at Loughborough University in 2014. That master's led to a PhD, and PhD led to employment through UK Sports Institute. So I've maintained the physiology capacity, going back for nearly 10 years now. Whereas my performance planning lead side of that role, that's something I started at the start of 2023. So about 18 months ago now. It's a responsibility that's just evolved over time. So in that capacity, I will lead the planning and review process of athletes' annual plans, athletes' quarterly plans, and the integration of all science and medicine support around that plan.
And you're based in Loughborough still at the triathlon center there. So can you tell us who are the paratriathletes that are based out of Loughborough?
Yeah, so we've got probably the majority of the squad based out of Loughborough at the moment. We have Dave Ellis and his guide, Luke Pollard. We have Claire Cashmore. We have Finley Jakes, Hannah Moore. I'm hoping I don't forget a few. Alison Peasgood, Brooke, and her guide, Brooke Gillies. So I'd say probably the vast majority of the squad are based in Loughborough full time. We also have guys that visit probably on a weekly basis. So it is it's the only training centre we've got on the para side, unlike on the Olympic side where we've got Loughborough and Leeds. On the para side, British Triathlons is just based in Loughborough. Whilst we only then still have a couple of athletes who are just based remote from the centre.
All right. And for people that haven't been following as closely, can you tell us what results you got and how you felt about those results, whether they hit expectations or exceeded expectations or hopefully not underperformed, but let's hear it.
Yeah, no, it was the best set of results we've had at Paralympic Games. So paratriathlon only started in the Games in Rio in 2016. This is only our third Paralympics, and it's the most categories we've ever had in. Of the 12 categories in the sport, we had 11 categories in there. So it was really great to see. So we had 5 medals, 2 golds, one from Dave Ellis and his guide, Luke Pollard, who are multiple world champions who had absolutely devastating luck in Tokyo 3 years ago where their chain broke. So that was some real redemption for them. We had another gold from Megan Richter, who's an athlete who has been around the sport for a few years, has struggled a little bit with injury, but had an absolutely brilliant race to take gold in women's PTS4. So that was the first time that race had been in. So she gets to call herself the first ever medalist or first ever champion in that category. We had a silver and bronze in the women's PTS5 category. So that was from Claire Cashmore and Lauren Stedman, respectively. Lauren won in Tokyo, and Claire was third in Tokyo. So they're multiple time medalists now. And then we also had a bronze medal from Hannah Moore in the women's PTS4 category, the same as Megan Richter. Who's another athlete who struggled a little bit with injury over the last couple of years. So it was great to see her put together a really, really strong season or a couple of seasons now, and get some reward from that. But beyond the medalists, we also had some fantastic performances, a couple of fourth places, a couple of guys still in the top 6. We had a few guys making their Paralympics debut, or at least Paralympics debut in the sport. So I think everyone who came home from Paris can be really proud of their results, regardless of in the top 3 or top of the podium or not. It's really positive, and really positive for LA. A lot of young athletes now who are very much on an upward trajectory for 4 years' time.
Yeah, that's really excellent to hear. And from an outside perspective, it looks as though paratriathlon and the Paralympics in general seems to have a lot more visibility in media, at least here in Portugal. I think that it's been much more talked about, much more in the news in general, with the Paralympics going on. So that's really good. Hopefully that trend continues and it can continue to lift the level of the sport. We'll come back a bit later to your role as a performance planning lead there and discuss what you do and get some examples and maybe even some applications for the listeners. But before that, I want to ask a bit more about your PhD research. And you told me over our email conversation that you basically had 2 strands to it. One was on firm regulatory strain and preparation, and the other one on how changes in training load can affect the immune system. So let's perhaps start with the first one, the firm regulatory strand of your PhD research. Can you give us an overview of that? And then we'll get into some practical applications.
Yeah, for sure. So for context, I started my PhD at the end of 2015. So it was basically just before Rio. And at that point, we were already looking ahead past Rio towards Tokyo. And it really didn't take an expert to look at Tokyo and the weather that we would expect for an August Games there to realize that was going to be a real challenge when it came to the heat, and I suppose more specifically for Tokyo, the humidity. So even before Rio, our attentions were thinking one Games further down the line. Very much considering that it was a relatively new challenge for us as a sport, as a new Paralympic sport. So at that point, it was a case of probably really just understanding what that environment meant to us. It's been, I don't know, decades worth of research showing that actually endurance performance in a sport like triathlon, it's going to be impaired as the heat goes up. That's very basic. It's well understood. Same for humidity. Humidity goes up, all else being equal. Ability to lose heat goes down. That's not good for performance. So that was a given. But really, we need to understand what that meant for our sport. So one of my first PhD studies was actually looking, well, what happens when we, as a sport, race in the heat? A sprint distance para triathlon, what we're going to be doing in Tokyo, actually, what does that do? What does that look like? Let's try to profile this rather than relying on relatively sterile research in a lab setting. Let's look at what that means in races. So one of my PhD studies, we actually went out to a race in Italy that was on the calendar pretty regularly. It was in Northern Italy in July, notorious for being quite hot. So race day, it was, I think, 33, 34 degrees. And we actually just got athletes to race as normal, but they raced whilst having ingested a core temperature pill. So we could see their trace of their core temperature all the way through the race, from pre-race and warm-up all the way through to swim, bike, and run, and afterwards. And it really first look at actually what happens to these athletes whilst they're competing in the heat. And that gives a real good profile as to what the actual challenge is, regardless of what research says of when you cycle at 60% of VO2 max for half an hour in 40 degrees. Actually, we know in para triathlon what that looks like. So we had 28 athletes in total. It was actually an international population, just to try and bump up the numbers a little bit. So of those 28 athletes, we had 22 of them reach a core temperature above 39.5 degrees. And 39.5 degrees is more often than not the cutoff point for most lab studies. So most university ethics committees will say, as soon as your participants reach 39.5 degrees, you have to terminate it. You have to get them out of the heat chamber, stop the protocol there and then. Actually, we're seeing the vast majority of athletes reach that point. And actually, a lot of them reach that point and are absolutely fine. So we know athletes are getting hot. And beyond that, of the 28 athletes, we actually have 8 of them above 40 degrees C, which arbitrarily is the point where you would say an athlete or a person has hypothermia. And again, some of them were absolutely fine at that temperature. So we knew we were seeing very high body temperatures. But beyond that, it kind of didn't really matter what the temperature said. It was how athletes felt and how they raced. So we also then, at the same time, we surveyed their incidence of heat illness. So tried to get athletes post-race, a bit of a questionnaire, really. What symptoms did you experience either during or post-race? And over half the athletes were experiencing symptoms of heat illness. And again, it wasn't a complete surprise, but it goes to show that athletes, when they're not prepared for the heat, are going to struggle. They're going to experience symptoms of heat illness, which come with deteriorated performance. So for us, that was really the first look at actually what the challenge is, and it was quite significant. And it was probably going to be even greater when we got to Tokyo and the humidity was higher. So beyond that, it was a case of, right, we know the challenge is high. We know the vast majority of athletes are experiencing high core body temperatures and experiencing heat illness. Let's actually start preparing for it. And again, there was a lot of research at that time around heat adaptation, either in a lab environment or outside. Lots of research from student populations, from military populations, from firefighters, but not a lot of it was very practical and applicable to the athletes we were working with in their context. So we tried to design a heat acclimation protocol, which we thought would actually be more realistic to elite athletes. So in that instance, we tried to balance your typical, I'd say, heat acclimation where you're in a heat chamber and you're cycling at a set intensity with more novel ways of getting a heat stimulus and using passive acclimation. So we actually used a mixed approach of probably 75% of acclimation in a heat chamber, cycling along for an hour and a half, and actually integrating that with passive acclimation, because vast majority of triathletes, they're not going to be riding their bike 10 days in a row. Whereas a lot of research would be having athletes in a heat chamber cycling for 10 days in a row. And we're not trying to really necessarily change what athletes do in their training. We're trying to fit heat acclimation in and around normal training. So we tried to integrate using passive acclimation as a stimulus to potentiate the heat stimulus throughout an acclimation period without necessarily disrupting normal training. And that was really effective. And it was the first probably research at the time to show that you don't need to go down the very basic and very sterile research methods for heat acclimation. You can try and tailor it around what elite athletes actually do on a weekly basis when it comes to training. And in that as well, we did that in the paratriatic cohort, showed the adaptation was possible, but we also got a group of athletes without impairment as well, doing exactly the same protocol, and showed that actually the level of results was remarkably similar, regardless of whether you have an impairment and some type of disability or not. Actually, heat adaptation is possible. So we knew the challenge was high when competing in the heat, but we also knew we could prepare athletes effectively and prepare athletes probably basically on our schedule rather than what a research would say is gold standard.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And thank you for that overview. I want to ask about the first part with the race in Italy. Was there any kind of correlation or any pattern as to athletes having a certain performance based on maybe not quite reaching those really high temperatures? Or was it really just a matter of some athletes were able to perform despite really high core temperatures, and there wasn't any clear patterns or correlations in that way that you could see?
It's probably more the latter. But from that that study that we did, but also probably the years since, whether it's lab based or whether it's in actual races, it does seem to be very individual and almost situation specific as to what temperatures athletes can tolerate. Some of that is going to be anthropometric. Some bigger athletes, some smaller athletes, they're going to have a different temperature that they can tolerate. Some of that's probably linked to just general fatigue. The more tired you are going into either a race or a training session, probably the lower that almost tolerable temperature. The same with hydration and fueling. Almost the poorer the state that you go in, probably the lower that tolerable temperature is before performance starts to go down. But yeah, there definitely wasn't a correlation between temperature going up and performance going down. It's, I'd say, definitely individual, and even beyond that, situation specific as well.
Mm. And then the second part there with the heat preparation, can we go into some more detail around what that looked like? So 10 days with a mix of active heat acclimation in the heat chamber on the bike and passive heat acclimation. How were the sessions constructed when the athletes were in the heat chamber, and what was the passive heat adaptation protocol like?
Yeah, so it was 8 days in total actually for that one. So we did 5 sessions in the heat chamber on the bike and 3 passive heat exposures. The active exposures on the bike, again, there's probably that's another specific example of where we took what research was saying, and gold standard in research was monitoring core temperature continuously and controlling the intensity to achieve a set core temperature, typically around 38.5 degrees. But the practicalities of that are quite tough, because more often than not in research, they use rectal thermometers for controlling core body temperature. I think I would be laughed out of the lab if I got athletes or I asked athletes to do that for 8 days continuously. There isn't much appetite for that, I imagine. And the alternative then would be core temperature pills, which are remarkably expensive. They're £40-£50 per use. So when you're looking at a squad of potentially 10 athletes over 8 to 10 days, it's just not feasible. So what we tried to do instead, or what we did do instead, was control intensity by using heart rate. And we said, actually, let's aim for a heart rate roughly around your LT1, your first threshold, based on a bit of pilot testing, as that's the point typically where athletes are reaching 38.5 degrees. So we used heart rate as the measure, to control the intensity, regardless of what power is. So the theory being that you control heart rate, and as you adapt, the power that you're pushing for that heart rate gradually goes up. So the stimulus stays the same, as opposed to controlling using power and heart rate going down. And that theoretically, each day, the stimulus is slightly diminished as you go through an acclimation period. Let's control the relative intensity and keep that consistent, so the stimulus each day is the same. So that's what we did. It was in around first threshold heart rate, slightly below. So that was for 5 sessions out of the 8. And then the passive sessions were actually just seated in the heat chamber post-training, more often than not post-run. So when athletes' core body temperature, skin temperature, sweat rate's already high, let's put you in the heat and let's maintain that and clamp it for a period of time. I would say, in hindsight, non-reflection, just seated in the heat probably isn't enough. And more often than not, now we use hot baths instead for our passive acclimation. Hot baths or saunas, I think heat chamber probably isn't enough of an oppressive environment to control and to clamp core body temperature high enough. But it is still an approach we use in terms of mixing active and passive acclimation. But more often than not now, it's either sauna or hot baths as opposed to just a heat chamber.
And how long would you aim to have the athletes in the sauna or in the hot bath nowadays?
In and around 30 to 45 minutes. Provided they've gone in with an already elevated core body temperature. So hot baths, we aim for 40 degree water, starting at 30 minutes. If that's tolerable, probably going up to a maximum of 40 minutes. Saunas, similar duration. It is very oppressive. So that's a case of taking breaks probably every 5 to 10 minutes, coming out of the sauna for a minute or so, cooling off slightly, because trying to sit in a sauna at 80 degrees for 40 minutes is very, very tough and probably not safe.
How does sauna technology play a role here? I'm thinking about things like infrared saunas. Do they do equally good job as classical kind of electrical stove saunas or even wood fire saunas?
Honestly, I couldn't tell you. I would imagine, thinking off the top of my head, as long as the air temperature is high, it's probably no different. And ultimately, it's air temperature that is creating the environment to then drive internal body temperature and skin temperature. So the means by which you're getting that increase in air temperature, I'm not sure, but yeah, air temperature is going to be the key.
And with the active heat sessions that you're doing on the bike, do you ever go beyond those sorts of like steady LT1 heart rate sessions? Do you ever do something more high intensity in the preparation, or is it always?
I'd say that's definitely an area where we've evolved over time. So when we look back to when we first started implementing heat acclimation, both part of my research but also around some hot races, some of the reflections were actually probably just leaving athletes a little bit flat, and there's probably a couple of reasons for that. One of them is probably just the overall fatigue that comes from doing acclimation is really high. And it does take some getting used to, and it means that you need to be extra vigilant with the basics of refueling, rehydration, just overall recovery post-session. And that's something that we potentially underestimated back 6 or 7 years ago. I think one of the considerations also is just the timing for acclimation relative to racing. And actually, because of the fatigue, you can afford, or you probably should need to push acclimation earlier and further away from racing and allow some recovery. But a big one, I think, is 6, 7 years ago, it was generally just all low, relatively low intensity. And I say relatively low intensity, it's hard to be too low when you're in a heat chamber. And potentially just missing some of the potentially more top end VO2 threshold work, which are a staple of most weeks for our athletes. So yeah, as the years went on, as we learned more, the more we started to include actually race intensity sessions. So mainly on the bike, but also a run session or two actually in the heat chamber. And in that situation, it's a case of probably more ignoring what temperature gets to, your internal temperature, because it will get really high. We try not to get too high, so we'll put fans on and trying to make it relatively tolerable. But in that case, it's getting the work done to a certain extent, but it's also perceptually understanding what it feels like to be running at race pace in the heat chamber, or to be riding at race watts in the heat chamber as well. And that seems to have definitely helped when it comes to post-acclimation during races, just not feeling quite so flat.
And what sort of temperature do you use in the heat chamber, or does it vary based on the predicted temperature in the goal race?
The approach we generally take actually is more a temperature to invoke adaptation rather than to mimic what race temperature is going to be. Because ultimately in a heat chamber, we can only really control temperature and humidity. We don't have solar radiation, which you have in races outside. We don't necessarily have the airflow, which you get when you're outside, especially on the bike and you're doing 40k an hour. So generally we go for a temperature and humidity to invoke adaptation, which for us is somewhere between probably 32 and typically 36 degrees, and humidity around 70 to 80%. So generally a relatively quite high humidity, but also a decent temperature as well. But based on the work that we've done, we know actually that high humidity can create a really oppressive environment that drives temperature up and then drives adaptation.
So you use humidity as a tool to really get that core temperature up and potentially more quickly as well, and not have to spend quite as long time in the heat chamber, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. So obviously for when we go back to Tokyo, humidity was going to be high. It made sense. Humidity was high in the heat chamber. Whereas for Paris just now, the humidity was never going to be that high on race day. But even when we were preparing in the heat chamber back a few months ago, we had the humidity up at 70, 80% because we knew that would make the individual heat acclimation sessions harder. It would drive core temperature up quicker. And it would mean that we could get an adaptation probably for a lower external workload as well, regardless of what then Paris looked like.
And have you used any of the home-based paint suit style protocols, potentially if athletes are away on training camp or they can't get into the heat chamber for whatever reason? Is that something that you've done much of?
Yeah, we have. I would say that the paint suits, sauna suits, they work better for probably turbo-based riding. I think it is still pretty tough to get a decent heat stimulus when running outside, unless it's also really hot outside. But the one area more on the sort of DIY end of the spectrum that we have used, probably going back since pre-Tokyo now, is like plastic greenhouses. So greenhouses that you put up at the bottom of your garden for growing tomatoes. Actually, some of them can be a really good size to fit a turbo and a bike in. So athletes who don't have access to a heat chamber for whatever reason, will be setting up plastic greenhouses in their turbo room, in their kitchen, wherever they might have probably 2 meters by a meter and a half space. And because of the nature of them, they only take a relatively cheap heater, a 20 pound heater you could get on Amazon, and you've got your own little heat chamber. And they work really, really well. So that's something that we've used over the last couple of years for athletes who don't have access to a heat chamber, for athletes who might be abroad. We had an athlete who was based out on the Canary Islands before Tokyo. And she had one of those little plastic greenhouses, plastic heat chamber, basically, set it up outside on a balcony with a little heater in there.
Yeah, that's a really interesting solution. Sounds really practical, and I love those sorts of creative solutions to be able to do things without access to all of the resources that that a high performance center has. So that's really cool. Thank you for sharing that. We could talk forever about heat acclimation, but we have some other topics to get to as well. So maybe we should leave it there. Is there something else that you think is important to mention, or some takeaways from this topic before we move on to the next one?
I think the takeaway is heat adaptation works for everyone. There isn't an athlete I've met yet who doesn't adapt to the heat. It might take a little bit more, a little bit less for some people. And generally, the more heat work you do, the quicker you adapt. But everyone will adapt to the heat, and everyone will therefore benefit from doing heat preparation if they are racing in the heat.
Yeah. So speaking of that, how long it might take, that reminds me that I did have one other question I wanted to ask, which was around the timing of when you do this preparation. So if we take the Paralympics as an example, when did the athletes do the heat preparation, and when did they, how much did they do in the maintenance period? How long was the maintenance period? If you can give an overview of that, basically.
Yeah. So basically for both Tokyo and Paris this summer, we took a very, very similar approach. So we did the bulk of our heat acclimation probably about 2 months before the actual race. And I say the bulk of that acclimation, that was a 2 week block where athletes would have been in the heat chamber or done about 10 heat sessions in that 2 week period. So that's quite an intense little block, and there is fatigue that sets in that second week and off the back of that second week. But by the end of that block, when you're potentially then 6 weeks out from competition, we then go into a period of heat maintenance. And this is something, again, over the last few years, something that we've learned a lot more about. And in that period, athletes were probably only doing two sessions a week for about 4 weeks. Because once adaptation is achieved, and once you've done a very thorough initial block, which we had, it's actually relatively easy to maintain that heat acclimation status. So as opposed to needing to do potentially five sessions a week to get there, actually maintaining it probably only takes two sessions a week, which is a lot more manageable, allows a lot more recovery and athletes to freshen up during that period. So then from 6 weeks out to 2 weeks out, that's what it looked like for our guys, was infrequent sessions in that period. And then from 2 weeks out, we then travel to our holding camp anyway. So in before Tokyo, we were in a place called Miyazaki, which was in the southwest of Japan. So we were then exposed to training outside in the heat and humidity anyway, every day, every session, to maintain that heat status. And the same for Paris. We're in a place called Le Bourne, which again, actually in the southwest of France this time, just outside Bordeaux. And again, high temperatures every day outside. So maintaining that heat stimulus. And instead of being acclimation in a lab setting, it's then acclimatization outside.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. Thank you for that. So let's move on to the second topic, the second strand of your PhD work. So this one was about how chronic and acute changes in training load might affect the immune response of an athlete. So can you give us an overview of that?
Yeah, for sure. So again, probably similar to the heat, my PhD was very much driven by questions that the sport had at the time. And as I say, it was a very new sport back in 2014, 2015, hadn't then yet actually been in the games. So there was just a general lot of learning from coaches, from athletes, from the world-class program. And one of the questions that seemed to have was, actually, a lot of our athletes seem to be coming down with illnesses around around big periods of training, around big training blocks, training camps as well. They're going away for a couple of weeks to Lanzarote, for argument's sake, and coming back, and they're ill. So it defeats the object of said training camp. So really, it was a bit of a question in my PhD as to what is happening here, and what can we learn, where can we improve? So one of my studies was around monitoring an antibody in the saliva. So basically, our first line of defense of the immune system is in our saliva and in our mucosa, an antibody called salivary immunoglobulin A, IgA for short. So that was that's an antibody that had been measured in a few of the studies in the sports setting, sometimes in team sports, a few individual Olympic sports as well, as a marker of immune health, basically. And there was some evidence in other sports that actually as training load goes up, IgA goes down, and that athletes are immunosuppressed and therefore likely to be picking up illnesses. So we decided to run a longitudinal study. So over the course of a 9-month period from the winter period all the way through to basically middle of the season, looking at weekly IgA concentration and how that then related to illness instance, but also what the effect potentially of training load was. And in reality, we didn't actually see a whole lot, which in itself was a good learning. So of all the training load metrics you could think of, from TSS to some of the training load measures, TRIMPs that have been used in research, there's actually no relationship between any of it and IgA concentration. So it was really hard to say, actually, training load goes up, IgA, and therefore immune system ability, for want of a better term, goes down. So there's no real relationship there. And equally, there's no real relationship between IgA and illness as well, even though we were seeing quite frequent illnesses over that 9-month period. There was actually no relationship to IgA. So that in itself.
Sorry to cut you off there, but those illnesses were also not related to the changes in training load with the metrics you used.
No, nothing we could see there either. So in reality, it felt like a little bit of a wasted study and a wasted period of time, but it still taught us something. It taught us that something like IgA, as much as the theory might be there, the practicalities of using it probably meant it wasn't a good monitoring tool. The level of variation with salivary biomarkers is really, really high. So measuring it in a sport setting at a squad level of 10 athletes or so meant that the noise is really, really high. And it really, the analysis techniques that we used were gold standard. They were lab based. They weren't on the spot results. So the samples were frozen and then analyzed in batch, which meant that there wasn't a live readout either. So there wasn't a dribble into a pot. Here's your result. Actually, immune system is low. Let's back off training. So it was probably, again, more just added to the collection of areas of actually, although science and research says this is gold standard, the practicalities of an elite sport setting mean it just doesn't work. But actually, one of the more impactful areas was, as part of that, we just got athletes to arbitrarily say, do they feel better than normal, normal, or worse than normal on a regular basis? And actually, there was probably more power and more predictive ability on how athletes felt and where illnesses might come in based on athlete subjective feedback on a very, very basic scale, as opposed to a relatively expensive and complicated biomarker in the saliva, which was then frozen and then analyzed in batch months later. Actually, simplicity was definitely better in that scenario, regardless of what supposed gold standard might be.
Yeah, that's super interesting. It's a bit tangential to that, I would say. I used to, in my coaching practice, ask athletes to measure morning HRV and resting heart rate, and in order to possibly be able to see if they were getting ill and things like that. But then I found that it's really shaky whether there's any kind of correlation. And actually, I feel like in many cases, the act of measuring means that the athlete doesn't ask themselves, how am I feeling? So they might actually reduce the chances of detecting that they're coming down with something because of that, I guess, implicit certainty or sense of predictability that the measurement and the data gives. So it's not quite the same as the saliva measurement, but in a similar vein, it's just quite useful to remember just how powerful just tuning into your body still can be in order to, I guess, predict these sorts of things.
Yeah, for sure. There's definitely parallels there, and it in reality, that's where we are at as a sport. We don't have any squad wide, any program wide objective measurement sort of wellness monitoring measurements or anything like that. We don't have squad wide HRV. We don't do squad wide salivary biomarkers or anything like that. But what we do have is some really great coaches who check in with their athletes every day and can actually ask athletes, how do you feel? And therefore make decisions based on that, regardless of, something an app might say, something that, your saliva might say, blood sample might say. Actually, just really powerful coaching conversations, so much more effective.
And do you have less illnesses now in this Paralympic cycle, for example, compared to the previous one?
Oh, absolutely, for sure. And I would say part of that is, the coaching expertise and the ability to check in with athletes. I think a lot of that is also probably a higher floor of basics from the athletes as well. I think we know a lot more about the importance, basics of fueling, of hydration, of sleep. So I think there's just a greater level of professionalism as well, and just more elite athlete behaviors, as well as from a coaching perspective, ability to check in and understand what athletes need on any given day, week, month, or year.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what I'm taking away from this, I guess, is to nail the basics of all of those things: sleep, fueling, hydration. Maybe because you mentioned that when you had issues with lots of illnesses, they often happened after training camps and so on. That's something that I've definitely noticed, that not so much training camps necessarily, but races, when traveling back home after a race, giving it an extra day or two before jumping into full-on training seems to help in reduce the risk of illness quite a lot. So those are some practical takeaways for me. Do you have any other practical takeaways for athletes listening to this for how to potentially reduce the risk of illness?
I really like the post-race and the travel one as well. That's, again, something which we've improved a lot over the last couple of years. I think we had a very, very real example around COVID. Obviously, everyone was really scared of catching COVID a few years ago. And that meant that everyone's hand hygiene, mask wearing was excellent. And as a result, actually, athletes weren't picking up other coughs and colds that weren't COVID at the same time. So we had a perfect example of actually, if you do the basics of hand hygiene, mask wearing, avoiding ill people, probably not going to get ill, regardless of what that cough cold strain is. So yeah, any travel, any long haul travel, it's making sure your station on a plane, wipe that down with antibacterial wipes. It's mask wearing. It's we use First Defense when athletes stepping onto flights, making sure that you have things like chewing gum, that the airways aren't getting too dry. It's making sure athletes aren't flying the day after the race. We know that racing triathlon, very high intensity, any high intensity, either training or racing, is going to suppress the immune system for a short period of time. So don't travel. Don't expose yourself to hundreds of strangers who might have XYZ coughs and colds when your immune system is already suppressed. Let's wait an extra day, have a full night's sleep, and then travel.
Yeah, no, those are all great tips. So now let's move on to discuss your role as the performance planning lead in Paratriathlon. So can you just give an overview to start with? What exactly does this role entail, and what are your day-to-day tasks?
Yeah, so within the UK Sports Institute, every sport will have someone who's leading on basically performance planning, integration of athlete plans, and reviewing athlete plans, the integration of science and medicine support around it. Sometimes that's potentially more on the coaching domain. Sometimes that's head of performance support or performance support leads within different sports. Within our Paralympic program, that is me. In reality, what that means is working very closely with the coaches that we have, understanding what they and what the athletes need from a science and medicine perspective, and therefore being a bit of a conduit between the coaching team and the science and medicine team in that regard, working with coaching athletes to actually look at where their performance is and where potentially it needs to be based on what they're looking to try and achieve. I'll also look probably more broader at the sport, understanding the performance trends, where the sport might be in a year or 4 years time when we get to LA, and therefore what actually performances at a more granular level of swim, bike and run potentially need to be to get to that point. So it's a very broad and probably not the easiest to define of roles. But in reality, it comes down to planning and reviewing of athletes' performances and their plans.
Yeah, I think that would be a good example how that particular aspect of the role in terms of analyzing the benchmarks that they need to achieve a certain performance and how, yeah, basically how you work from that and how you help the coaches. So do you have a case study or an example that you could use where basically explaining a little bit of everything that was done over a period of time, whether that be a season or a Paralympic cycle, and yet your role within that athlete and what they did in that cycle or that period of time?
Yeah, for sure. Probably a good example is one of the athletes we had racing in the games, whenever that was this week. It feels like a year ago already. So her goal was to win the games. She was already a Paralympic medalist, already being a world medalist. Understandably, when you're at that level, the goal is therefore to get onto the top step and to win the big one. So when we're looking at actually the aspirational goal is to win, and we're sat down at this point, probably October of last year, you had a 10-month, 9-month period to get to that point. It's then understanding, right, the goal is to win. What does that performance actually look like? So it's then at that point we go down a bit of a data dive. So we dive into the data and look to win Paralympic gold in your category, what does that look like across swim, bike, and run? So we can pull out performances at a world championship level, a Paralympic Games level, a World Series level. Actually, what does the winner achieve across swim, bike, and run? Because ultimately, that's probably what he's going to have to take in Paris. At that point, when we're a year or so out, we're not expecting a big jump. It's probably going to be roughly what we seen on the last couple of years. So we can work out swim, bike, and run, what the breakdown performances look like to win Paralympic gold. At that point, it's a gap analysis as to, right, we know what swim, bike, and run, what you need to achieve to do that. Where are you currently? So for this specific athlete, she was already basically doing what she needed to do from a swim perspective. So swim was there. There was no gap. That's maintained where we're currently at from a swim perspective. However, there was a gap from a bike and run perspective. From bike perspective, we had a very real example of what the gap was from the test event from last season. So the athlete in question was second in that race. The athlete who won was realistically the athlete who was potentially probably going to win in Paris. And there was a gap on the bike. So at that point, we knew, right, there's a gap of, I can't remember how much time there was in the on the bike at the test event. But in reality, time doesn't really matter too much on the bike, because we can then break time down into both power and resistance. So using some of the tools we've got, some of it publicly available on things like Best Bike Split, some of it in-house, we can see based on this, I can't remember exactly what it was off the top of my head, let's say it's 90 seconds. How do we close that 90-second gap in terms of both power and CDA? How do we lower the resistance? In reality, we had to do a bit of both. So the power demands we knew was probably having to hold 210, 215 watts, as opposed to realistically probably around 200. So we had about a 10 to 15 watt gap in power that we needed to close over a year. But we also potentially could get some of that gain from new bike and looking at more resistance rather than looking at the power end of the spectrum. So there's a potential gap there as well. And then lastly, from a run perspective, quantifying run gap is a lot easier. It's just time. But realistically, we knew there was a gap of about 30, maybe 45 seconds from a run perspective as well. So we knew what the gap was to achieve the performance demands, to achieve the aspirational goal of winning the games. At that point, it was, right, what is the plan? How do we achieve said, how do we close the gap across specifically bike and run? So from bike perspective, it was, right, we need to find 10, 15 watts from somewhere. Okay, so at what point or where do we achieve that? So part of that was, actually, we know you're going to have to hold 210 to 215 watts on the bike in the race. Okay, in that case, all your race pace sessions are going to be at 210 to 215 watts. And we're going to create sessions that mimic the up and down nature of the Paris bike course. Because for us, that it wasn't overly technical, but it was a very stochastic bike. It was very wide roads, very wide corners. But there was a lot of them. So there was a lot of surges and up and down on the power, but on average, we're looking at hold 210 to 215 watts. So let's bank a load of sessions at that point, regardless of what that relative intensity is at 210 to 215 watts. And let's start off on a relatively low duration and just pad that out as we go through the year. So you're getting more and more exposure at 210 to 215 watts. And at the same time, let's look at the bike and let's look at, can we get a better bike for you, which is looking, can we lower the resistance? Can we get something that you're more comfortable on and you can take those wider corners quicker? So we're not hemorrhaging as much time in them as well. So there was a coaching element and session design element, but there was also a technical element as well. So time in the wind tunnel, can we look at helmets? Can we get a few watts based on helmet, or can we tweak position a little bit so that we can get some gains there. So there was a performance plan around that gap analysis to achieve that performance. And from a run perspective, it was similar as well. It was a case of, well, if you need to, again, arbitrarily run 18:30 off the bike, you need to be therefore capable of running probably 18 flat, if not slightly quicker, in a standalone 5K. So it's a case of, right, well, we've got a performance marker here in that you need to be capable of running quicker than 18 minutes, if not 18 flat. So that's then a performance test that we can look at multiple times during the year and say, actually, are we on track for this? And equally, if you need to be running 18 flat 5K in standalone race, we therefore roughly know where your second lactate threshold probably needs to be, which is slightly slower than that pace. So again, when it comes to lab testing in a relatively controlled environment, we have a target as to where that can get to as well. And then it's a case of actually who is delivering around this plan. So who's delivering from a bike perspective, who's delivering from a run perspective. If we're chasing a 18 minute flat 5K, and that might be a 30 second PB and a 30 second gap there, actually that potentially might require more running. As weekly run volume goes up, there's more load that's going through the body. So therefore, from a physio perspective, from an S&C perspective, can we put a safety blanket around said athlete because she needs to run more to close a 30-second gap on the run to then actually be on the top step of the podium? So that's a very convoluted example of actually breaking it down from the performance and the aspirational goal of winning a Paralympic gold, but all the different areas that need to integrate and need support around it to close that gap.
Yeah, I think what I find the most interesting here is how you go from knowing what the gaps are and what you need to improve by how much you need to improve it to actually knowing how you improve it. And obviously, you can never know this, but you mentioned there on the bike that you just did the race specific sessions at the target power. So you're basically training to the demands of the event and letting the physiology sort itself out in a way from the sound of it. On the run, was that also kind of the approach that you trained a lot at that target 18 minute 5K pace for a flat standalone 5K? Or did you do something else from a run perspective? And can you also just discuss the pros and cons of like using that approach that you talked about on the bike versus maybe trying to go in with a magnifying glass into the physiology and trying to find where the physiological weakness is, but then perhaps moving further away from what you actually need to do where the rubber meets the road?
Yeah. So interesting, we actually did something different on the run, and it was more along the lines of training to your physiology, for want of a better term, rather than training to the performance demands. And there's probably a couple of reasons for that. One was, the athlete's overall run history wasn't too great, so she didn't have a huge history and huge bank of training volume for a run perspective. So it felt like there was probably more of a risk of reaching and running at the quicker speeds at the race demands rather than accumulating training volume. So risking probably more injury potentially. And again, this is very subjective, by running at faster speeds than potentially in some ways the physiology would permit. So that was probably one of the reasons. Second one was probably the athlete's physiology in the first place, where she is more of a sprint type athlete in the grand scheme of paratriathlon anyway. Hasn't really struggled with top end work, VO2, but potentially has more of a deficit when it comes to aerobic base from an LT1 perspective. So it was probably more training a relative weakness from a run perspective rather than making a strength a superpower. So it was trying to push up a base and trying to close a gap rather than make what is already pretty strong even stronger.
Yeah. And did you then do periodical testing to see how she was tracking on the bike and the run?
Yeah, for sure. And reality is that something that we do across the board, and I think there's a whole lot of value in that for every athlete, because it can provide regular feedback and a regular basis for review potentially to see how athletes are tracking across swim, bike, and run. So 3 or 4 times a year, we will get athletes in the lab. We'll do relatively standard submaximal testing for first threshold, second threshold, VO2 max, etc. As means to see, are we tracking to where we need to be? And if we're not, do we need to change anything? So from a run perspective, and that's relatively easy, we know roughly what second threshold you need to achieve a 80-minute flat 5K. So therefore, how are we tracking towards that over the year? And same for a bike. Actually, if we're looking to hold 210 to 215 watts in a race, we know second threshold needs to be at least that, if not slightly higher as well. So we've got a good basis to say, are you on track for the performances that you're aiming for?
Did you do any other maximal testing other than the actual degraded exercise test to establish VO2 max? Did you do something like time trials over certain distances or durations, or was it the lab based max that you did to establish VO2 max?
Yeah, no, just lab based for VO2 max. We do time trials more in a swim perspective, but in terms of actually a VO2 max measure, just lab based.
Yeah, how reliable do you find the correlation between, let's say, finding a certain LT2 on the run and then extrapolating that to a 5K pace? Basically, how repeatable do you think that is? Because one could argue, like devil's advocate, that you might test one day and your LT2 might be, let's say, 350 and per kilometer, and the next day it's 340 or 335, even based on what is going on, what you've eaten, and a number of things. Whereas a pure time trial is a bit more reliable in a way, or less uncertain, less variability in the data.
Yeah. I don't think there's never a perfect test. And I'd say, yeah, definitely when we're looking at sort of like correlation between LT2 pace and say 5 or 10K pace, even, it's not 1-to-1 and it's never 100% accurate. It's in reality, it's a guide. And I would say from a lab profiling perspective, you can have a lot more certainty in the results. Like the more tests you have on an athlete, you get to understand what is a real result and what is potentially a little bit off and potentially one to disregard. If we get athletes in for the very first time, I take most results with a pinch of salt based on there's no historic data to compare it to. Whereas some of our athletes who are in the lab 3, 4, 5 times a year for the last however many years actually have a reasonable degree of certainty as to what the results are and have some confidence in this is real, this is potentially a little bit off. Whereas athletes who are relatively new or we see more infrequently, yeah, I think it's always a huge caveat as to this is the result, but it could be swayed one way or the other.
Yeah, that makes sense. And when you have athletes that you have lots of data on, you can also see that maybe they perform very consistently in racing or a season, and then the lab tests that you've done that same season can basically determine the coefficient of variation in the actual testing for that athlete. So then you know roughly plus minus what that means when you do a future test. You mentioned already one of the things that you're doing as well is looking at the trends in the sport, how things are changing, how things are leveling up, I guess, mostly. So can you talk about how did things change between the previous Paralympic cycle and Paris, so between Tokyo and Paris, and also forecasting a little bit, what do you think is going to happen leading into LA?
I would say at this stage it's very subjective as to what I'm seeing, but the performances are just going up and up. The level of professionalism in the sport is going up. The races are getting a lot closer. In reality, it's getting a lot harder. Really, really is getting a very hard sport. Triathlon in any way, shape or form is really hard based on the training volume that is necessitated. And that is exactly the same in the paratri world. And we're seeing that increase as the sport has had more Paralympic games. I'd say looking back to when I first started in sport 10 years ago and the Rio cycle, athletes could get away with coming into the sport relatively late and having success. Whereas now it is becoming more like what we're seeing in Olympic triathlon, where actually larger training histories are needed and that athletes are on a longer pipeline to success and need to be in the sport for longer. It's getting harder to come into the sport and have success straight away. So as part of my 12-hour journey home yesterday, I was having a little look at the medalists from Paris this week. So there's 11 categories, therefore 33 medalists. Of those 33 medalists, 30 of them were in the top five at last year's World Champs. So only three of them have come in some ways out of the blue. Now, of those three, two of them didn't even race world championships for some reason, probably injury. So in reality, we're seeing serial winners as opposed to athletes coming in with a naive training history and having success straight away. I just don't think that can be afforded anymore. And I think the technical aspects of the sport are getting to a higher standard. If we look at the quality of some of the bikes that we saw in Paris this week, it is really high. There's a lot more nations who are having bespoke tri-suits, we're having sleeved tri-suits. The level of innovation is going up. So it's very much on a very steep trajectory to a very high professional level. And that will absolutely continue through to LA. I've no doubt about it. That it'll get higher standards.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's fascinating as well with the equipment side of things. In some of the categories, especially where you really need some special engineering to potentially optimize each individual bike for the athlete. And I guess what maybe this is one of the challenges for the sport is that it can potentially be more resource intensive than Olympic triathlon for that reason. Also with things like having guides for the PTVI category and so on. So it might be a little bit of a bigger difference between the haves and the have nots in a way. But that's I guess something for World Triathlon to think about. And I guess they are usually trying to have different programs and projects in place to support developing nations, which is a good thing. But as an engineer myself, my background is in engineering, I find it fascinating that potentially like hiring an engineer to custom build bikes for the paratriathletes and optimizing them completely for each individual's unique needs in a way that you wouldn't need to do in Olympic triathlon. But let's finish off with some, like a few assorted questions, let's say. I'll skip a few of them because we are already quite far into this interview. But I want to ask if you could wish for three topics or research questions that you could fund with unlimited resources, which topics or research questions would you like to see answered or investigated at least?
That is a very good question. There's one that's definitely in my mind is around training duration and the balance of training duration, training intensity for basically aerobic sessions, swim, bike, and run. What is the balance? And almost, can we get to a point where we understand for a 3-hour ride, it should be X relative intensity, say relative to your first threshold. Whereas for a 4-hour ride, it needs to be Y intensity. So basically just understanding the balance between training duration and training intensity, but from an aerobic perspective, because logically we say, actually, the longer the ride, let's say, because that's probably the one we see the most variance, the longer the ride, the lower the relative intensity. But is that right? And how much should it go down? Because generally, you're probably not going to do a 2-hour ride at the same power as what you do a 4-hour ride. But should you? Should you not? Is that balance right? And actually, what is the power of a 4-hour ride versus a 2-hour ride anyway? How much are we getting from that second 2 hours? Is it linear and that actually it's going up, or is it exponential? So really, it's, for me, it's a very loose area of training duration and training duration during aerobic sessions.
Yeah, that is such a good question. I love that. I think I would pick that one too. And also because, especially when it comes to elite athletes, in a 5-zone system, the zone 1 and zone 2 is huge, whereas zone 3, zone 4, and zone 5 are relatively much smaller. But where we have the most information is really kind of LT2 and between LT2 and VO2 max. That's where we know the most. And it's not that big of a range in terms of intensity for elite athletes, especially compared to the huge range of intensity and also where the time is spent and the energy is spent in a training program. So yeah, that would be my pick as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. The zone 1 to 2 is huge. In reality, like, athletes' efficiencies and economies aren't that much better in elite athletes. So therefore, the energy demand, even at 90% of first threshold, is still really bloody high. If you're pushing 300 watts, that's still 300 watts of calories you need to put in, regardless of if that's below first threshold or not. So yeah, it becomes really hard to fuel the demands when you get fitter, because everyone is limited when it comes to either their economy or their efficiency. So it is definitely a challenge when it comes to elite athletes.
Yeah. Do you have two others, or is that the big one?
That's definitely the big one. I would say one that's potentially linked to that is, are there strategies we can employ that might almost circumnavigate or expedite the adaptation we get from that type of, say, 4-hour ride? So the one that I'm potentially thinking of is something like blood flow restriction. So actually, can that be used as a means for adaptation at the aerobic end of the spectrum? So potentially one of the mechanisms for adaptation from high training volumes and your long rides, your long runs, is just the repeated shear stress of the blood vessels from your heart pumping at, I don't know, 120 minutes for 4 hours. So actually, there's a lot of stress that's going through the blood vessels and their walls. They stretch, and that's a stimulus for actually the generation of new capillaries, new blood vessels around the muscles. Basically, open up more road networks for the traffic that's coming through. But actually, is there a way we can get that adaptation without having to be on your bike for 4 hours and for fueling 4 hours worth of riding? So actually, something like intermittent blood flow restriction during aerobic, either cycling or running, is that a stimulus, or is that a sufficient stimulus for that blood vessel stress and the shear stress that goes through the capillaries? So intermittent occlusion and reperfusion. So if we can occlude blood vessels for a short period of time, release any occlusion, there's a big blood pressure almost spike and push through the capillaries, through the blood vessels. Does that get the same level of stress and stretch as 4 hours worth of 120 beats per minute? So that's something we're kind of looking at and kind of playing around with. But if someone could answer that and provide a bit more certainty, that would be ideal.
Yeah. And do you have a third one?
I'm always going to try and sneak a heat related one in there, because that's definitely the area that I've spent the most time in. It's probably extrapolating, expanding on some of the stuff we already know as to like what actually is the minimum effective stimulus to hold on to heat adaptation. We think two sessions a week is enough. Can we get away with even less? Can one session a week be enough? Can one session every 2 weeks be enough? We don't really want to risk it and it not work. So trying to get some idea as to almost the minimum effective stimulus for holding on to heat adaptation, and equally for how long as well. We think we can get away with 4 weeks. Actually, can we get away with 6 weeks, 8 weeks, even longer, and move that heat acclimation even further away from competition?
Yeah, I think Ventrenesto did something like that. You're probably very familiar with that, but I believe they had three sessions a week in their maintenance period, but they could hold on to the adaptations for quite long, as far as I can remember from that. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see if you then go down to two sessions per week or even one session per week. Yeah, what is the minimal effective dose, as you say? But yeah, I'll put a link to that in the show notes, actually, because I did interview him about that study some time ago, a year or two ago. So listeners that are interested can go and listen to that one as well. And then the next question that I want to ask is, what is something that you've changed your mind about in training or performance or physiology, or simply something that you approach differently now than you used to?
I would say I'm a lot less driven by what we might see in research or what we might see as gold standard, and a lot more sympathetic to what actual triathlon training looks like and what coaching looks like and what coaches need and want, what athletes athletes need and want, versus what we might see on PubMed, what we might see published in some more of the basic journals. So if we take, I don't know, something like a taper as example, the research will say a reduction in training volume of 60% over 2 weeks. It could be mono exponential, it could be stepwise, whatever it might be, and it's a maintenance of training intensity, when actually we look at what that means in a sport like triathlon. It's actually, well, where does that fit when you're traveling, I don't know, halfway around the world to a Yokohama World Series on a Monday, and you're landing Tuesday morning, and you don't have access to most of the training facilities? Actually, you're probably not going to get a gold standard taper in that period of time. And you're then racing at 5 o'clock in the morning, for argument's sake. So actually, how can we work in the context of what the sport is, regardless of what a gold standard taper looks like? What does it look like when you're considering the demands of the sport, the logistics, and almost athlete perception and the sports culture as well? Like triathlon is a culture of high training volume and independence and the love of training. Actually, you don't really want to take that away from someone for a gold standard, so to speak, taper. So that's probably an example. Or something like warm up as well. Gold standard would say, I don't know, 5-6 minutes worth of work above your LT2, above critical power, finishing 20 minutes before the start of the race. Whereas the practicalities of that, when you're putting a wetsuit on, you need to go to the toilet, you need to then go to lineups, you need to potentially do some pre-pool work. Actually, you're not going to get a gold standard in that scenario as well. So a lot more sympathetic to what the demands of the sport are, what the perceptions of the coaches and the athletes are, versus potentially, again, what research might say is the best.
Yeah, that's a great answer. And you also answered one of the questions that I skipped there, which was about discussing the balance between using science to inform practices and I guess, breaking new ground or and being ahead of science or and using the demands of the sport. So two birds with one stone there. And what is the best or most influential book that you have read?
I don't know, but I would say one that I'm reading at the moment, which is Failure Is Not an Option by Gene Kranz, is very good. And I think there's definitely a lot of take-homes for our world in sport. So Gene Kranz was a flight director in NASA during the moon landing period, during Gemini, Mercury, and Apollo. So he was one of the flight directors for the first moon landings. And it's basically his memoirs almost from his time working in NASA in the 1960s into the 70s. And it really talks through the decision-making process during flights, the planning that goes into it, most importantly, everyone understanding their role, the level of communication that is needed in a team operating at such a high level with back then relatively limited technology, but very, very high stakes. So that at the moment is a very good read. And like I said, definitely some parallels we can take home to high performing teams on the need for clear communication, clear planning, a lot of what if scenario planning and forecasting, and the power of very good reviews and the post-mortem process.
Yeah, that is super interesting and sounds very relevant for any performance environment. And to finish off, can you give three tips to amateur endurance athletes that want to improve their performance?
I would say understand the performances that you're aiming for. So have yourself a goal and really spend time in understanding what the performance needs to be to achieve said goal. So regardless of whether that goal is Kona or if it's Cardiff, understand what you need to achieve from a swim, bike, and run perspective and really start putting the plan around that. So once you have the understanding of the performance that's required, whether it's in that race or whether it's the qualification to get to that race, you can really start pull together a bit of a gap analysis to where you are now versus where you need to be, and therefore what support is needed and what strategies you might need to close the gap. Second one would be to do the basics and do the basics right. Doing the basics of fueling the demands of training, rehydrating, of having adequate sleep. So you're 7 at least, if not 8 hours of sleep every night once they're in place, and you're avoiding things like coughs and colds. You're avoiding any undue risk that might be a knock to training. Everything else becomes significantly easier. We say it to athletes, like their best ability is availability. If you can be available to train by doing the basics, you're definitely on the road to success. And the last one would be find something you enjoy. In a sport like triathlon, endurance sport, there's a lot of time that goes into it, and a lot of hard work, a lot of financial commitment at times. So it's finding what you enjoy, because once the enjoyment is there, the motivation to do everything you need to do, and sometimes it can be a struggle. We see it even at the elite end of the spectrum. It can be really hard to train, but doing it because they enjoy it. So find something you enjoy and go with that, because once that's there, it'd be easy to get yourself out of bed at 5 a.m. in the morning for a fresh old swim session.
Yeah, those are all great tips. And I guess the final question then is, are you anywhere where people can follow you, social media or ResearchGate, anything like that?
I'm on ResearchGate. I'm on Twitter. They're probably the best avenues. I can't say I'm the most active, but there'll be the odd thing or two. So search Ben Stevenson, my mug will come up somewhere.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Ben, for sharing all of this. It was a pleasure to talk to you, and hope to do it again another time.
Thanks, Michael. It's been a pleasure.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com with plenty of links, including links to Ben's research articles that we discussed today, as well as some related episodes. For example, the interview that I did with Ben Trenestad, and also an interview that I did with Bex Mills, where we talked a lot about paratriathlon in general, because Bex used to be the head paratriathlon coach at Loughborough. I have some personal takeaways from this interview, and the main part that I think is very relevant for a lot of people listening is the heat preparation, because lots of races are quite hot these days. So heat prep is no longer just an option, but a must in many cases if you want to perform well. So the things that I like to highlight from this heat prep conversation include, first of all, the fact that you can use a mix of active and passive heat preparation to be able to fit the heat preparation into your training schedule rather than fit your training schedule into a heat preparation protocol. This is really good thinking, in my opinion. And I think that that's something that I would recommend. Number two is the timing of the heat preparation. So being okay with doing the main heat preparation block quite far ahead of your goal race and then using maintenance sessions to maintain these adaptations. This, as we discussed in the interview, is supported by some studies conducted by Dr. Ben Trenestad. And as I said, this episode is linked to in the episode description. But in the applied context here, Ben talked about how they are kind of getting away with doing two maintenance sessions per week. And that seems very promising. And I have to say that for me, this is something new, doing the main block of heat prep that early, that far in advance. And it is really interesting and definitely something that I'll look into a bit more and experiment with. I think that is a fascinating discussion in general around the best timing of heat preparation. And the third point here, third takeaway, is around the DIY heat preparation using a plastic greenhouse and a heater to simulate a heat chamber. This sounds quite next level compared to the paint suit protocol that I have used and have coached athletes to use, but I think that it makes a lot of sense. It sounds like it's probably a bit more painful, but probably also a bit more effective. Now, before we finish this episode, I want to once again remind you and perhaps inform you, if you didn't listen to the previous episode where I first announced it, that our Mallorca training camp will be back between the 5th and the 12th of April in 2025. The camp consists of 7 nights with 6 full days of training, and the days around that being check-in and check-out days at the hotel. We are based in Alcudia by the sea and close to the gorgeous Tramuntana Mountains in Mallorca, a UNESCO World Heritage for those interested. The prices are from €910 per person, and this includes the 7 nights at a very nice resort hotel. It also includes breakfast and dinner every day, access to the hotel spa every day, access to all the training facilities, and of course, all of the training and coaching over the course of the camp. And I think especially for self-coached athletes, it's just a really good opportunity to interact with coaches. So with me and the other scientific triathlon coaches, and get tips and advice that you can use way beyond the camp when you get back home to your own training. You can take learnings with you from discussions that you've had out on the bike or at dinner or wherever it might be. There's lots of opportunity to interact with coaches. So this is a positive aspect of the camp that I want to emphasize. We had a full camp last year, and we unfortunately had to turn people away at the end. So please register sooner rather than later. At the moment of recording this, which I do about a week before actually publishing the episode, we have already filled almost a third of the available capacity. So it's not a rush yet, but you also don't want to wait for too long. You can get a full refund until the end of January if you have to cancel later on. So that's always a good option as well. I won't be too long-winded and discuss too much more about the camp. Just go to scientifictriathlon.com and click through to the training camp page, or use the link in the episode description and read all about it. And then you can email me with any questions you might have, or you can simply go ahead and register through the form on the camp page, and then I will contact you with the next steps from there. I hope to see you in Mallorca, and please don't hesitate to contact me if you have any questions. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high-quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. There are a range of options from drink mix to gels to choose, so you can easily find your personal favorite. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS24. And thank you to Zenate. The Zenate Sintner is a great tool to have in your toolbox to improve your technique and power, to target specific aspects of your stroke, and to maintain consistency when you don't have time to get to the pool. You can try the Zenate risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on zenatesintner.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.